what is happening in the past 19 months is a continuation of building a gender apartheid in Afghanistan. And I think what's happening is going something beyond what we understand as the concept of gender apartheid, because at least in gender apartheid, people of the same color are allowed to interact with each other. That's not happening in Afghanistan, where women, based on their gender, are effectively in prison in their home. And the recent development, as you mentioned, is that the board that UN Special Rapporteur used was very strong. The gender prosecution, which could be prosecuted, it said amount to gender bound to crime against humanity. So this is the development that's happening. Women are no longer allowed in Afghanistan to go to school. They cannot go to university. They cannot work, neither in public sector nor in NGOs, which that by itself affect 11.6 million women in Afghanistan, according to UN data. And then Afghanistan is one of the countries that has one of the largest population of widow women because of the 4 decades of war we have. So there's a lot going on with women in Afghanistan. And what's happening is, unfortunately, we are really having a little sense of how do women in Afghanistan are living this day their lives, but not having access to public life, not being able to fully and even very minorly to participate in life in Afghanistan, in public life in Afghanistan. So what we are hearing is that there's no legal protection for women in Afghanistan, especially for those that are fleeing domestic violence. As we know, even before the Taliban take over, Afghanistan was one of the countries that was rated as a worst country to be a woman in. And also we had reports from Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission before saying that 95% of violence against women were happening at the home. And what is really the scale of that violation, that violence against women in Afghanistan? I feel that we don't have a clear view of what is exactly taking place, because a lot of independent journalists, media are shut down. They cannot function because of the Taliban censorship, because of the Taliban threat and intimidation that we continue to hear and also experience as our journalists are in Afghanistan and working and trying to raise the voice of women from Afghanistan. So what we are hearing is a lot of concern, a lot of strong languages in terms of saying what's happening, but what we are seeing is little action to actually reverse this human rights violation, to take a powerful and strong and global stand that this should not be tolerated. As Richard Bennett also mentioned in his report, that it's intolerable and should not be normalized. And also what we are seeing in Afghanistan is some level of normalization of these violations.
So, Zahra, can you talk about how life for women, everyday life for women in Afghanistan, has changed in these last 19 months? Your newspaper, Zan Times, spoke to some women. Tell us what they told you ahead of International Women's Day.
So what they're telling us is a sense of depression, a sense that you wake up every day in your life and you have nothing to go for. There is nothing for you to stand up and say, this is what I will be doing today. There is no hope for education. There is no hope for you to contribute to your society. And what we are hearing is a lot of sense of hopelessness among women. And they're committing suicide in greater number. However, it's so hard to get data, as I said, that the Taliban are severely repressing and suppressing media and freedom of information in Afghanistan. So there is a lot going on in the lives of women who see no hope or no light at the end of the tunnel. This is one part that we obviously see and read about, and we hear from the people and my colleagues who are working in Afghanistan. But also, there is a hope. Those women that protested yesterday in Kabul, they know what they're facing with. They know that when they go to streets and ask for their rights, it's gone. It's the killing. They might be killed on the streets and nothing going to be changed, but they're still willing to take that risk because that is what's going to, you know, bring them hope. There's a fight for them to resist for their fights and what they want, even if that comes at the cost of their own lives. They are willing to take that. That's one way that they go to the protest. And as we see that there's a lot of crackdown, the Taliban are torturing, arresting, beating them on the streets and also kidnapping them. We have women right now in prison, like Narges Sadat, who are in prison because they protested, because they asked for their rights. This is one way they are continuing to come to the streets and resist. However, there's other ways that they continue their resistance. And that's so recently I wrote a piece about women creating online spaces for themselves to come together. And their fight is to keep hope alive for themselves, because they know in this darkness that they're facing, that there is no hope for them. They need to survive, because they need to think beyond this, beyond what's happening in today. And that is something that they're trying to read books, to have a sense that this dark days will pass, and they have to be ready for when it's passed, and they have to have their motivation, their hope is still there for them, that they can continue. So the resistance, the women in Afghanistan are courageously continuing, but there's little we are seeing that the international community is doing to support these voices, to support the justified demand of these women in Afghanistan, who are half of the population, and they deserve, they need, and their rights must be protected. If it doesn't, I think it's very hard to speak of an international community and speak of human rights as universal standards.
Zahra, can you talk about what do you think the international community can do to stand in solidarity with women, and speak specifically about how Afghanistan is also confronting this horrific humanitarian catastrophe, and how that's been exacerbated by sanctions as well as massive cuts in foreign aid?
Thank you. So I'm going to go back to humanitarian crisis. Right now, as we speak, an estimated 28 million people in Afghanistan are needing urgent assistance. What that really means is that since the Taliban take over, there is one two-folded issue that we have to speak about. One is that the humanitarian crisis didn't happen by itself. Of course, it happened with the withdrawal and also the return of the Taliban. But what's really exacerbated this crisis is the Taliban cutting off half of the society from essentially making it impossible for them to earn their living. That is one crucial point that we have to always consider, how the people of Afghanistan can overcome this human rights crisis and humanitarian crisis if the Taliban won't allow women to work. And also they stop some of industries like music. They won't be functioning because the Taliban said that this is illegal, it's haram for them. So there is a lot of this humanitarian crisis is created directly by the Taliban's policies. And there is one side we are seeing that money goes to Afghanistan, humanitarian aid still continue, and we have UN appealing for $4.6 billion for 2003 in Afghanistan, and that's a lot. So there's also concern about the money that we are seeing, $40 million, which is arriving in Afghanistan weekly. Where that money is being spent is a huge question for the people of Afghanistan, because what we are seeing on the ground, what we are talking to the people, they are telling us that this money is not reaching its intended recipients. Those who are most at need, women who lead a household, women who doesn't have a mahram, we constantly talk with them, and they say they are not able to access this aid. So this is a big question in terms of thinking where that aid that is arriving in Afghanistan, where that aid is going. We are very worried. That's the people on the ground telling us this money is helping sustain the Taliban. And that's a worry. And I'm raising here as a way to raise an accountability and monitorship of seeing where this money is going, because we don't want this money to feed the Taliban and sustain them. So there's this part of the humanitarian crisis that is happening in Afghanistan. But how can we go beyond this is actually thinking about the society where all the people of Afghanistan have their own rights. So they have the ability to actually earn their living. That ability is right now taken away by the Taliban from half of the society, to say the least. And for the other half, there is so many problems created by this Taliban, which won't allow them to continue their work, continue their living. So when we are talking about humanitarian crisis,
Zahra, we have 30 seconds.
We have to see all of this. So humanitarian crisis cannot be seen as only one single issue and something that encouraged the countries to engage with the Taliban. The action that needs to be taken, I really welcome the action that the European Union taken to sanction two Taliban ministers, but that is not enough. We have to go beyond that. What can be done is that the international community is standing together, especially the countries who have feminist foreign policy and the countries who have a strong demand on human rights, a strong stand on human rights. They have to come together and they have to think over this as a global issue. This is something, this is not about women's rights in Afghanistan only. This is about women's rights globally. And if we cannot deal with this in Afghanistan, be assured that this will extend it to other countries. And this, that is very unfortunate. And I hope that we can call on this special day to all women across the world that please stand up for Afghan women, please stand up for their rights, because they don't have the means to fight back the way you see other women in other countries can fight. They don't have the means to come to the streets every day to make sure that their voice is heard, because they are being beaten, they're being tortured, they're being kidnapped. So they need your help to, they need you to stand for their rights and speak and pressure your governments to take, to be accountable, especially if your government is one of those that were involved in Afghanistan in the past 20 years. You need to take them accountable and to say what's happening in Afghanistan is intolerable and it must be stopped, and it must be stopped now.
Zahra Nadar, we want to thank you for being with us, freelance Afghan journalist, formerly a reporter with the New York Times in Kabul, now based in Ottawa, where she is editor-in-chief of Zan Times, a new Afghan women-led outlet documenting human rights issues in Afghanistan. When we come back, we go to Iran. Stay with us. کنی برای کفن و بروش مگه بهش نمیخواد نموشم هدیه بکن شعارا رو اخیابون داری میشنوی محصول شاشیدی تو خود به میگی رو قاتم الو تخمه در رو بکن نمون داره بیت رفریه میخوان بفرسیم پیش خاصف سه دلالی این که از ازادی کفه بری کن ها بر میخواد تو این بسی جیه زن ندیده عشق هم کریم نه ناموساس رهایی و شهید فربریم از شمال و جنوب و شرق و غرب کشوریم همه متحد شدیم ستم و نره بزنیم خونه هم بردیم و جاری کردی سه شده براش داری خرق میشید از تو پا بزن سه دشتار Revolution by the Iranian singer, rapper, songwriter who goes by her stage name, Justina. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we go from Afghanistan to Iran, where parents and teachers have been holding protests in Tehran and other cities following a spate of apparent poisonings at girls' schools since November, intensifying recently. According to the group Human Rights Activists in Iran, there have been at least 290 suspected school poisonings in recent months. The group estimates at least 7,000 students have been affected. A number have gone to hospital. They just collapse. Meanwhile, the head of Iran's judiciary said earlier this week that Iranian women could be punished for violating the Islamic dress code. His remarks came just months after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody, sparking nationwide protests. We go now to Manisha Mouradian. She is an assistant professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Barnard College at Columbia University. Her new book is titled This Flame Within, Iranian Revolutionaries in the United States. She's part of Feminist for Jina Network. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Professor Mouradian, if you can start off by talking about the significance of International Women's Day in Iran and what's happening with women today, especially the spate of the horror of these what look like poisonings.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for having me here today on International Women's Day, which is a very significant day in the history of Iran. And maybe I'll start there, because in 1979, just after the popular revolution that overthrew the Shah, it was an uprising of tens of thousands of women that began on March 8, 1979, in Tehran, that posed the first challenge to the authoritarian turn, you could say, of the revolution. It was those women who poured into the streets on International Women's Day 43 years ago, who rightly understood that the enforcement of mandatory Islamic dress code, mandatory hijab, was part and parcel of the erosion of all of the democratic promises of the revolution. And unfortunately, at that time, their demands, their desires to continue the revolution, to actually achieve gender equality, were sidelined and undermined and ignored. And that's why it's so historically significant and really unprecedented that this current uprising, which, as you said, began in September, has actually has had as its starting point demands for gender and sexual freedom, liberation, and equality. The poisonings that you referred to, these horrific chemical attacks on girls' schools that have swept the nation, have to be understood as a punishment against women and girls who have been leading this nationwide revolt for several months now. And in response, people have been protesting. In fact, the National Teachers Union called for nationwide strikes, sit-ins, and demonstrations. And by my latest count, there have been such demonstrations in at least 17 cities. This is a nation in revolt. You know, in the face of the imprisonment of dissidents, in the face of executions of dissidents and mass torture of dissidents in prison, and now these latest poisonings, people are not accepting this. They understand, after many years of experience, that the system, unfortunately, cannot be reformed in Iran, and people have drawn revolutionary conclusions. And it's very significant that right now, in Iranian Kurdistan, in Salkez, the hometown of Mahsa Jina Amini, the teachers are on strike right now, defending the right of women and girls to education, but also condemning the broader state repression and the economic crisis that's really impoverishing ordinary people in Iran. Of course, Salkez is where this uprising began in September with the slogan, Women, Life, Freedom, a slogan that is all about life and joy, echoing some of the themes earlier in your show that are connected, deeply connected to feminist movements and to International Women's Day. So the Islamic Republic seems to have nothing to offer but prison and torture and death, whereas this uprising is all about life, is all about celebration of connecting with other human beings, overcoming alienation, overcoming the fear and shame and humiliation that the Islamic dictatorship has imposed on people, and actually trying to reorient the entire society in a new direction.
Professor Mouradian, could you talk about the origins of this protest? You're a member of the Feminists for Jina network. The fact that these protests were largely, if not in many areas, exclusively led by women, and of course men joined, but women were really at the forefront of these protests.
Absolutely. In many ways, we have to understand what's happening now, as I said, as a continuation of that women's uprising that was all too fleeting in March of 1979. In other words, women have paid a very heavy price for the fact that the Islamic Republic has built its sovereignty, has built its ideas of nationhood and authentic Shiite culture on the bodies and on the backs of women. And so for decades now, women have experienced legal discrimination, second-class citizenship, and just the daily humiliation of having to move through public space under the threat of police harassment, detainment, torture, and even worse. So when Mahsa Jina Amini was killed in police custody, supposedly picked up for wearing improper hijab, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, in a sense. And it just crossed a line for people. You know, Iranian women in many ways never stopped struggling for their rights. There have been many women's rights campaigns, many efforts throughout the last 43 years to change the discriminatory laws, to fight through parliament, through the courts, through many, many avenues. And so people have gotten to this point through struggle and through learning some very painful lessons that this regime is not willing to change. So when the movement erupted in Iranian Kurdistan in Salkaz, it was incredibly significant because it also meant that the kind of feminist politics that have been leading this struggle have been what we call intersectional. And some Iranians use that word. But even if they don't, the point is that the marginalization of Kurdish peoples, the ethnic and religious discrimination, and the incredible class inequality of Iranian society have also been at the heart of this movement. In other words, people understand that we can't separate out the oppression of women and gender and sexual minorities from all of the other oppressions in the society, including that of ethnic and religious minorities. So this is really a moment in which a nationwide uprising was triggered in response to state patriarchal violence, you know, against women, and a kind of refusal to go along with that anymore. So the oppression of women has become a catalyst for all of the other grievances in the society and really led millions of people to conclude that they need a new government, but not just a new government. They want to transform society at every level, in personal relations, family relations, everyday life. And I think it's that revolution, the revolution of everyday life, that no amount of state repression may be able to stop.
Maneje Mouradian, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Assistant Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College, author of This Flame Within, Iranian Revolutionaries in the United States. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we end today's International Women's Day special looking at abortion bans. Five women are suing Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risk to their health and were non-viable in the first such lawsuit since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. This comes as women's rights activists Monday called for the Inter-American Court of Human Rights to condemn El Salvador's total ban on abortions, which has been in place since 1998. The demands center on a case brought a decade ago by a woman, Beatrice, who died after being forced to carry a pregnancy, although the fetus could not survive. For more, we're joined by Selena Escher, a Salvadoran-Swiss filmmaker who directed the award-winning documentary Fly So Far about the criminalization of abortion in El Salvador, where dozens have been convicted and imprisoned after having miscarriages, stillbirths, and other obstetric emergencies. Selena, welcome back to Democracy Now! It is great to have you with us. We look from the United States to El Salvador. Is El Salvador the United States' future? Talk about the total ban, but also the resistance.
Hello, Amy. Thank you for having me. Yes, exactly. In El Salvador, well, abortion is still criminalized. There is no possibility to have an abortion in El Salvador. Women are still criminalized and in prison. But there is a big resistance still happening in El Salvador. Although we're living in a state of exception since 1 year, people have lost their human rights and people are being unjustly incarcerated in El Salvador. There's a big movement who have tried to legalize abortion in 4 cases and also in 3 cases. But now feminist leader Lorena Peña, she's facing a lawfare. She's being persecuted, and she's the woman who's also in my film. She wanted to legalize abortion in 4 cases, and now she's facing a persecution, political persecution. So in general, there is an authoritarian regime happening in El Salvador, and feminist activists, journalists, dissident voices, everybody is under threat. Everybody is being persecuted. And yeah, this is a really difficult situation that people are facing in El Salvador right now.
Selena, could you talk about what happened with the release of your film, which was banned in El Salvador, and the stories that you hear from people who are featured in the film, if you could elaborate on those?
Yes, exactly. Well, last year in August, we wanted to have the cinema premiere in El Salvador. We have shown our film in 90 international film festivals, so we decided to launch to have the cinema premiere. But then anti-choice organizations, 12 organizations, made a legal threat to the cinema. If they show our film in the cinema, they will make a legal threat. So then the cinema had to take down our film, and so we didn't have the cinema premiere. They tried to silence the voices and the stories of the women of the 17, but We have shown our film in community screenings together with the protagonist, Toda Vasquez, and her organization, Mujeres Libres, across the country. So we are trying and to show our film in many, many ways. But as we see, the evangelical anti-choice groups have so much power. They are trying to silence us and trying to silence the stories of the women.
And could you talk more, Serena, about the origins of this law? You mentioned in 1998 this new abortion law. How did it begin, and where do you see it going now?
Well, abortion was legal in three cases before 1998. Then it was a total ban of abortion in all cases. It was not possible to have an abortion, even if your life is in danger, in cases of rape or the fetus will not survive outside the womb. So in no cases was legal. And feminist organizations have been trying to legalize abortion since more than 30 years. But it has been really difficult and almost impossible to legalize abortion in El Salvador. Now, feminist organizations have brought the case of Beatriz in front of the Inter-American Court, and we are hoping that with this case will open up for the cases of the other women, and it will force El Salvador to change the abortion law. Last year, also, the case of Manuela was held in front of the Inter-American Court, and the Inter-American Court ruled in favor of Manuela, saying that El Salvador is guilty for all human rights violations committed against Manuela. But the government has done nothing, and they don't want, Bukele doesn't want to change the abortion law. He already said that he will keep life that begins, the life begins at conception. So he only wants to be reelected, but he doesn't want to change the abortion law. So we will try with this case to open up and to make more pressure to the Salvadoran government.
Selena, tell us about these cases that are before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the case of Manuela that you just mentioned and Beatriz.
Well, Manuela was a woman who lived in the countryside. She could not read and write, and she was pregnant. She had cancer, and then she had a miscarriage because of the cancer. Then she was criminalized in the hospital. She was sentenced to 30 years of prison, and she died in prison, leaving two sons behind. And what we want is justice for Manuela and justice also for Beatriz. They are both women who lived in a situation of poverty. They needed to have an abortion. For example, the other example, the case of Beatriz, she had lupus and she was pregnant, but the fetus had no brain, so it didn't have any chance of survival outside the womb. So she asked the court to have an abortion, but they denied her. And so the state forced Manuela to keep the pregnancy, and it was torture for her for 7 months. It was really a torture for her. And then she had gave birth with the C-section, and then the fetus died after after 3 hours. And then she died years later because of the health issues she had. So the state is forcing women to keep pregnancy, also forcing young girls who have been raped to keep a pregnancy. This means torture for the women and girls. So this is these
Selena,
two cases.
We yes. just have a minute, but I wanted to ask you to put El Salvador in the context of Central America and Latin America overall, where you have what Argentina and Colombia legalizing abortion. What's happening in Central America overall?
Well, after in Colombia and Argentina, abortion was legalized. In El Salvador, in Central America, happened a major setbacks because more and more conservative right-wing evangelical politicians who are in power are causing a major setback in reproductive rights. For example, in Honduras, it is not even legal to decriminalize abortion, not even to talk about it in the parliament. In Guatemala, they made a family law that also said that abortion is totally prohibited. In Nicaragua, abortion is also totally prohibited. And El Salvador is the country that is most extreme law where women are unjustly criminalized for 30 and 40, 50 years of prison for aggravated homicide.
And Mexico, we have just 10 seconds.
And in Mexico, in Mexico now it's legal to have an abortion, and it's anti-constitutional to criminalize abortion. Though at least this it's happening progressive.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Selena Escher is a Salvadoran Swiss filmmaker and the director of the award-winning documentary Fly So Far, speaking us to us from Stockholm, Sweden. That does it for our show. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Have a productive, successful, happy International Women's Day.
Bonne fête, rendez-vous. On est déjà en mars, ce qui veut dire que les célébrations entourant le 25e anniversaire des Rendez-vous de la francophonie sont en cours. Dès maintenant, visitez le rvf.ca pour voir ce que les Rendez-vous vous ont préparé.
Radio Rewind.